99 bottles of beer on the wall, 99 bottles of beer. Take one down, pass it around, 98 bottles of beer on the wall.
The power of the imagination is an amazing dimension in our lives. It enables you to expand slivers of memory, to conjure up impressions of people long gone, to, in a way, retrieve the past. For me, as a writer and performer, my imagination is something I'm completely reliant upon. Here in New York, I've always been intrigued by British people who, like me, have settled here. You'll meet one later on. I was first captivated by him after seeing him on TV as a teenager. And even though he's passed away, he continues to hold a fascination for me to this day. The impulse for my piece was, what would it have been like if he and I had actually met? Then there's novelist and screenwriter Meg Wolitzer, who's haunted by memories of school friends on Long Island who died tragically young and so remain forever children in her imagination. And as for comedian Wendy Spiro, her imaginings have been directed towards trying to conjure up the father she never knew. She now wonders what it would have been like if they had got to spend time together. She's gradually retrieving fragments of data for her imagination to go to work on.
Faces in the street melt into the mist, but a face in a photo now I know I truly miss. I can now see how he kissed me and so, imagining him.
My father died when I was 10 months old. He died during a minor surgery. So it was always just me and my mom, this amazing, vaguely dysfunctional twosome in a cluttered one-bedroom apartment in Manhattan. I had the bedroom and my mother slept on a pull-out couch by the kitchen. But all of her geometric brooches and pumps and control-top pantyhose were kept in the master room, mixed in with my growing collection of Smurfs and Legos. Mom worked full-time, from 8 a.m. to 10 p.m. every night, as a sex therapist. She looks exactly like Dr. Ruth, this 5-foot-tall sex education expert who appears a lot on American TV, but even shorter, and with 7 layers of shoulder pads. She's the only mom I know who would leave her house so her daughter could get some action. One Saturday, my high school boyfriend was over, and Mom just offered to go to the Guggenheim Museum to give us privacy. So we took her up on it. We were making out full force in the living room, but Mom came home early and was greeted by a probably horrific image of 2 naked high schoolers awkwardly migrating from 2nd to 3rd base. But she just walked on by. She was like, Wendy, don't mind me. Continue what you're doing. I'm just coming through for a moment. I'll be in the kitchen. I'm almost gone. I'm almost leaving. And I'm gone. She was tiptoeing, as if not to make a footstep noise, because it would, of course, be the footstep noise that would ruin the sexual momentum. Later, she sat me down. Wendy, we need to talk. Mom, don't worry. We're not having sex. You're not having intercourse yet? Why not? I don't know. Well, do you participate in mutual activities? Yes, Mom, yes. And then she gave me the greatest, most informative sex book with suggestions that made me very popular. I feel bad because growing up, I wasn't nearly as supportive of her sex life. There were a few boyfriend interlopers that managed to get through my barriers, but they rarely lasted. But there were 2 other key players here. My father's parents, who live 5 blocks away from me and saw me twice a week up until 9th grade. My grandmother was a busty woman with intensely permed gray hair, and my grandfather resembled Einstein, with a dark Floridian tan cultivated during 20 summer vacations in Boca Raton. He and my grandmother, understandably, had been devastated by the sudden death of their only child, and they became obsessed with me and the preservation of his memory. I'd be happily playing in the sandbox, and my grandfather would lean in, twiddle with the unruly hairs on his face, and whisper, "You are my immortality, Wendy." It was a bit much to absorb at age 4. I'd be like, "Thanks?" My grandma would even call me by my father's name, by mistake. "Gary! Go get the ricotta cheese from the kitchen!" "Okay," I'd reply, thinking, here we go again. Just play along. In fact, my grandmother had a habit of fainting at the mention of his name. Towards the end of my bat mitzvah service, in which I looked like a flat-chested, slightly pimply Judy Garland, the rabbi announced, as is standard protocol, "Will everyone in mourning please rise?" And 12 years after my father's death, my grandparents rose. But, swept up in the emotion of it all, my grandmother couldn't deal, so as she stood up, she fainted and fell to the ground. Only moments after the congregation let out a collective gasp, 2 ambulance men came running through the side aisle and took her away. I was in a panic at the pulpit, not knowing what to do with myself. We hadn't practiced this, but because I had heard from my mother that she had fainted before, I knew she'd be okay. And she was. At the reception, she was her normal, jolly self, with an ice pack attached to her head. I actually have the whole thing on tape. I know it's horrible, but my friends love watching the fall, because it starts out with this boring religious service, and all of a sudden, grandma's down. It never gets old. Despite all the melodrama at the ceremony, my grandfather ended up giving a speech later that day about how I was a living embodiment of my father's memory. For 40 minutes. 40 minutes. 40 minutes.
We're so grateful that you've joined us in celebrating this great event in Wendy's life, who is not only charm personified and a determination to succeed in whatever you tackle. And as a father and a grandfather, I have dedicated my life to my family. And with all of its tragedies, I can say that I am happy to have lived to see this day and my Wendy, a living embodiment of the essence and the core of everything that I have dreamed about. God bless you, darling Wendy. We love you so much.
So whenever the subject of Gary accidentally came up, or whenever I did something small and cute that reminded them of him, my grandparents never said things like, "Oh yeah, your father liked cucumbers too." Instead it was, "Let's take out the album and talk about how you must carry on his legacy and weep." My mother took an entirely different approach to Gary. She knew I felt uncomfortable when my grandparents forced the subject on me, so she went way the other way and mentioned him rarely. I think she was taking the "when Wendy's ready to ask, she'll ask" approach. Or maybe it was just too painful a topic for her to discuss. Or maybe she feared she'd open herself up to me too much and that would somehow make her a bad parent. My mother has always been so selfless that she never wants to burden me with any of her problems. She can talk to me about how to have a better sex life for hours on end, but she had a pacemaker put in 7 years ago and didn't tell me until last October. So I really didn't know anything about Gary. I knew his name was Gary. Mom and I have always referred to him as Gary, never father or dad. I knew he was a psychiatrist. And I really didn't know anything else. I really had never been curious. This was how it was until a few years ago, at age 28, when I started working for an older married man in his mid-30s, my first male boss. Despite his large bohemian beard and his recreational pot smoking, He is an important vice president, and I am his administrative assistant with little interest in and thus no short-term memory for anything administrative-related. In order to make myself feel worthy of a salary, I try doing what I think I do better than administrative assistants, breaking up the monotony of office life. Sometimes when he's in the bathroom, I'll go into his desk drawer and sprinkle pinchfuls of pink glitter all over his presentation materials. Once, early on, when he was doing an on-camera interview about market trends, the reporter had to stop and say, people, we're going to have to shoot that again. Sir, I think you have a sparkle. My boss looked up at the ceiling, shook his fist in the air, and bellowed, Wendy! And then in this quasi-angry, almost not kidding voice, he said, Wendy, seriously, I found glitter on my deodorant. Enough. When he returned later that day, I marched into his office, and I just told him. I was like, look, I am never going to be one of those typical, you know, boring, competent people. So if that's what you really want, then I have to leave. He answered, calm down. You know I love you. Last Tuesday, you went and stuck a gold star on my paycheck. And then he took me to lunch and gave me fatherly advice about my roommate crisis. And then he handed me this t-shirt he bought me from the Colorado airport. All of this got me thinking that a dad, if he was at all like my boss, and in my current fantasies he is, might actually have added to my life and supplied a good balance to my mom. Like when I was a kid, I loved playing board games, but my mom refused to sit on the floor with me to play the games. Instead, she'd drag a chair in from the dining room and awkwardly lean down when it was her turn to move a piece. I bet a dad would have sat on the damn floor. And maybe a dad would have been brave enough to take me out of the country on a vacation to Mexico, instead of sort of leaving the country and taking me to New Mexico. My mom took me to all these fancy adobe restaurants and kept saying, Wendy, look around. It's like being in a foreign country. Only we can drink the water. So basically, I'm thinking a dad would have been more fun, like my boss. But my boss is not my dad at all. In fact, he had his own kid. And then when that happened, I got to witness a fratty, party-going executive dude transform into this mushy parent. When his son was first born, he said, yeah, I mean, it's cool. I really love it. You know, I mean, it's cute, but I feel weird kissing it, you know, because it's a guy. He denies it now, but he really said this. But as weeks went by, my boss became completely invested. I once saw him kiss the baby on the lips for 5 minutes. When the baby became a toddler, my boss would get him on speakerphone at the end of every workday, and the toddler would say, okay, Dad, I love you, bye. Let's have lunch. My boss would program him to say things like that. I started to wonder if my father had been into me in the same way. Since he'd been a therapist, maybe he would have called me from his office and had me say something like, okay, Dad, I love you, bye. I'm afraid we're out of time. See you next week. Then I simply became obsessed with my boss's kid. When the boy started calling up his dad himself, I'd answer and coo, what did you eat for lunch today? Pasta, he'd answer. Do you like pasta? Yeah. Do you like the shapes of pasta? Yeah. Do you help make the pasta? Yeah. Maybe we can make pasta together sometime. Is my dad there? Sorry, hold on. I thought, if I'm feeling this devoted to my boss's kid, how insane must it be to be an actual parent? And then one evening, I had a work party at my apartment and my boss showed up. As soon as he made it up the stairs, he started looking at family photos. On a lower hidden shelf was a small framed picture of me and Gary. Gary was lying in bed and I was nuzzling into his burly beard. My boss said, Wendy, why is this picture so hidden? I mean, this photo was important. It should be on the higher shelf, on a middle shelf or a top shelf. He was noticeably disturbed for the man in the photo. And for the first time ever, I felt sad about Gary. Sad for a father whose child never remembered him or took the time to find out about him, or even acknowledged that he had lived. My boss had only been a father for a short time, but the impact that he'd had on his son was profound. I thought, if, God forbid, anything bad ever happened to my boss, it would be truly just the most horrible thing for his son to never know how great he is. Maybe because I felt self-conscious asking my mother too many questions directly, or maybe because I was scared I'd upset her if I pried too much about their life together, I casually asked her to make a list of Gary's friends, people I could maybe get in touch with. She gave me a list consisting of two names. Out of grammar school, high school, college, medical school, she had two names. Okay, then. So I called the first one up, someone Gary had known since childhood. We met at this dark Italian restaurant. He sat down and he immediately said, "So, I guess you want to know about your father. We were very close, actually, until we were about 6 or 7. Then we pretty much lost touch after that." And that was it. That was all he had. And right before this, he had ordered extra bread, soup, salad, dip, pasta, and a chicken dish. We were about to embark on a 5-course meal for no reason. Well, he did mention one important thing. Apparently, Gary was good at tag. Good to know. I called the other guy who I knew was a college buddy of Gary's. He lived in San Francisco, so there was no chance of a pointless discussion over endless orders of chicken cutlets in an inappropriate bistro. He said that Gary was known for being jokey, quirky, hammy, and unconventional. But when I asked for specific examples, he answered, "Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I don't remember a lot from college. We did smoke a lot of pot, so, you know." Okay, when and if any of my friends have a baby, I will be sure to tell them. I will befriend your baby. I will keep in touch with your baby. And in case you die, I will tell the baby all about you and how much you loved your baby. I will do that for you. That is the kind of person I am. But Gary didn't have any friends like me. But then Mom hunted through my grandfather's old film footage of Gary and me. She suggested I have it converted to VHS. So I did. And I sat at home eating Skittles while watching grainy, close-up 70s film footage of a chubby, bearded man kissing his newborn baby to bits.
Wendy.
It was strange to hear him say my name.
"Wendy, talk to me. Oh.
Then he picked up the camera and filmed my mother, bouncing me and being overprotective as usual.
"Dad, say hello to Daddy. Dad, say hello. She's eating me. Come on. I don't want to put the light in her eyes, Gare."
"Okay, just leave it like this. Get a few feet in. The light is beautiful. It's a perfect... Oh, there's a great shot.
Look at Daddy. What's Daddy?"
For the first time, I saw my family as a threesome and not as a twosome. And I heard my mom say the word Daddy. Wendy, wave to Daddy. Wave to Daddy. I never realized she called him Gare. Even though it's the same apartment, the light and the quality of the film make it look like an oil painting.
I am less alone, I now see how he kissed me, and so, imagining him.
And then my mom gave me his diary. He had kept it during college. I came across this passage. I swear this is what it said. "It scares me to no end when I think that my time here is so short. Life is just too short. So weird." And then there were literally 10 column pages rating the models in Playboy. From what I've gathered so far, it seems that my father was affectionate, funny, pot-smoking, and horny. the type of guy who definitely would have appreciated glitter on his expense reports. I don't wish things had been different. The twosome with my mother was hilarious and amazing and perfect. But now I also have a connection with my dad.
Wendy,
hello. Speak to me, Wendy. Say something, sweetie. Part of it is that it's not as weird to call him my dad. And I think that my taking an interest in him, finally, after so many years, is bringing some peace of mind to my family, who never quite figured out the best way to integrate him into my life. My mom, who actually just got married, it was this big affair. She was this blushing bride with a registry and a veil and everything, and it was really adorable. She is suddenly calling me every day with random information about him. Wendy, also, he loved Lenny Bruce. And Goldie Hawn. And he went to Brussels one summer. It seems a floodgate has been opened. My dad died before he got to enjoy fatherhood, but he did at least have a chance to experience the roller coaster of adolescence. Imagine if you died before you got to high school. Imagine that. Imagine if you never got to consider seriously what you wanted to be when you grew up. Sadly, that was the fate, one after another, for many of Meg Wolitzer's schoolmates.
We all fall down.
I still can't get over the deaths of children I knew when I was growing up. It's as if after all these years, the kids were coming back to life in a graveyard off the Long Island Expressway and telling me things.
Little monkeys jumping on the bed. One fell off and bumped his head.
The first one who died was named Fabrizio Coletti. We were 7. He had a rare Mediterranean blood disease. In the class picture from that year, he has a head shaped roughly like a peanut.
No offense, but my head was not shaped like a peanut.
And red corduroy overalls with a train stitched onto the front.
The overalls had a train on them because my mother liked them and I didn't want to disappoint her.
It could break your heart if you think about it too long. It could kill you. It could actually give you the rare Mediterranean blood disease that he died from.
Wear the overalls with the train. It's your class picture.
We won't be back in time for the pictures. Those transfusions take forever. Let him wear what he wants, Rita.
Everyone remembers me as a kid who was always out, always sick. I missed the Halloween spook house and the mock pilgrims and Indians first Thanksgiving.
At school, we made Fabrizio get well cards all the time. We probably wiped out the entire supply of crayons on Long Island.
Children, try and say something positive in your cards.
I did, Mrs. Bodinger.
Eric, I don't think that writing Dear Fabrizio, I'm glad I don't have a rare Mediterranean blood disease is positive. Meg, I really like what you've written. Would you please read it aloud?
Dear Fabrizio, you have such a kind smile. I know you were not here for the phonics unit, but you didn't miss much. Yesterday, I drove by your house, but the lights were off, so my mother said we shouldn't ring. I hope you feel better and that you'll be back in time for the trip to the bottling plant. Sincerely, Meg. Fabrizio never made it to the bottling plant, but the rest of us did. It was 2 days after he died. We were still pretty shaken.
Hey, you guys want to hear something? My mom said that they gave him 7 transfusions.
Well, I heard that they...
And so, the foreman's job is to make sure that each and every bottle gets a label.
Do you think there's a...
I'm straight, too. No wrinkles. Hey,
guys,
are any of you kids listening?
What if we get his disease?
Is that possible?
Oh, shut up.
The next one was Robbie Kemp. Brain tumor.
One fell off and bumped his head.
Like Death Be Not Proud, the book about that brilliant and sensitive kid who gets into Harvard but then he dies of a brain tumor, except for the fact that Robbie Kemp wasn't brilliant or sensitive. In fact, he was a pig.
Hey, Meg, you like playing softball?
Yeah, why?
Because I heard you really enjoy going to third base. Can I try?
Oh, shut up. You're disgusting.
True, I was disgusting. But this was my big opportunity to disgust girls, wasn't it? Most guys get a whole lifetime in which to do that. Am I right? I only had till age 14, a period of abbreviated disgust.
He was right. There would be plenty of disgusting men to cross my path in the ensuing years, like Neil.
Look, you like getting it on, and I like getting it on. Do I have to keep taking you out to dinner first? It's kind of adding up.
Robbie died back in 9th grade. His funeral was a really big deal.
Dear lady, can you hear the wind blow? And did you know your stairway lies on the whispering wind? A cheese buying a stairway.
She's buying a stairway to heaven. Good afternoon. Welcome, friends, to Temple Bethel. To quote Robbie's favorite song that we've just been listening to, there's a lady who's sure all that glitters is gold, and she's buying a stairway to heaven. Now, who exactly is this lady? My bet is that she's a lady who young Robbie would have liked to meet. A lady he might meet still.
Then there was the usual kind of death. Once again, the person who died wasn't someone I was close to.
One fell off and bumped his head.
This time it was a girl named Debbie Bayless who never talked to me in her entire life. Well, that's not true. She did talk to me once on the school bus.
Can you, not sit here? It's reserved.
Debbie Bayless was a cheerleader.
S-U-C-C-E-S-S, that's the way we spell success. V-I-C-T-O-R-Y, victory, victory, that's our cry. D-E-A plus T plus H, they tell me it's all the rage. Baby, baby, don't cry for me. In many ways, you are just like me, but my life stopped while yours went on. I never even made it to the senior prom.
None of the kids who died were my friends, but all of them were just close enough to be disturbing. My high school was huge. We probably didn't lose any more kids than the national average. It just seemed that way.
I'm gonna sit, yeah, back to school, yeah, way down inside. Honey, you need it.
Later on in college, away from home for the first time, my roommate and I would sit and look at old high school yearbooks. Hey, Stacy, see this girl?
Yeah.
She died senior year.
No way. That is so sad.
Didn't you know any kids who died when you were growing up?
Not really.
How could the lady actually buy the stairway to heaven? Would she go into a stairway store and say, excuse me, do you have one that goes right up to heaven? Those lyrics suck.
I never stopped thinking of those kids. I thought about them much more after they died than when they were alive. I cried and cried each time. We all did. We cried for ourselves, huddled together in the cafeteria over plates of baked ziti italiana. And the school psychologist, a woman named Dr. Young, who wore peasant skirts, was brought in to talk to us.
Okay, who would like to tell me what grief means?
Over here.
I see a lot of hands. The girl in the maroon velour zip-up shirt.
Well, in Peanuts, Lucy is always saying, good grief, Charlie Brown.
Good, yes. Well, that's a good start.
I don't remember what else we said to Dr. Young. We talked a lot, I'm sure, the way children always do, all full of ourselves, never shutting up. We raised our hands to ask questions that weren't really questions.
Why do parents tell you dumb things like when your dog died that it ran away?
Excuse me? Are we missing English today?
We just wanted to hear ourselves talk because we could talk. Because we weren't Fabrizio Coletti or Robbie Kemp or Debbie Bayless or even the ones that followed a few years later. To be honest, I forget their names by now.
Excuse me? You forget my name? I was in your homeroom. I lent you my pen.
And me? You forgot me, too?
But the thing is, it all started to add up. And it wasn't just kids now, of course, but adults, too. Every time I called home, My parents gave me some news.
Oh, honey, I wanted to tell you that Ed Kimmel died.
Oh, Mr. Kimmel from down the block?
That's right. It was very sudden.
Oh, well, that's too bad. He was what, 75?
I was 68. Only 68. Still working. Still going in every day to Kimmel and Wenick refrigeration and cooling systems. Hey, I don't hear weeping. I don't hear sorrow.
It's just that those kids who died, they were the ones who seemed tragic. Adults seemed to me to be, I don't know, fair game.
That's what you think now.
Those kids gave me my first taste of mortality, and it was so unnatural, so abnormal, and yet it happened, which let me know that it could happen to me, and I was frightened.
I'll have you know, my daughters wept at my funeral. Wept! Hey, every life counts. Every death is tragic.
But mine was extremely, extremely tragic.
Those kids, they missed everything.
Yeah, like the moon landing.
And third base. Home base. Actual sex without clothes on. Just skin against skin. Can you imagine?
Real love. Senior varsity squad tryouts.
And then everything else. All the things you can't begin to imagine. Am I right?
Imagining. Yes, everything else that hasn't even happened yet.
Imagining.
I can only imagine my school friends as they were when their lives ended. I can't begin to think how they would be today. They don't offer me words of wisdom from beyond the grave, but I remember them more vividly as I get older. David Kale remembers someone who was important to him growing up, a celebrity who was an unconventional role model who died a decade ago, but who David continues to look up to.
Faces in the street melt into the sleet, but the face far more real is the one I dared not meet.
In the mid-70s, there was a TV movie made of the life of Quentin Crisp, based on his autobiography, The Naked Civil Servant. It made a big impression on me and my younger brother Simon, growing up in Luton. After the film was broadcast, Simon, who was 14 at the time and is completely straight, became obsessed with Quentin. He'd sit up at the dining table. His lips would purse, his face would begin to morph into a 60-something-year-old, and then in a fey voice he'd announce to me and my mother and father,
"My name is Quentin Crisp, and I'm an effeminate homosexual."
My father would become agitated and yell at him to cut it out, which just egged my brother on.
"I'm the last of the stately homos of England."
"Stop it!" Every time the phone would ring, my brother, as Quentin, would snatch up the receiver and inquire in a provocative tone,
"Hello? Who wants me?"
prompting most callers to hang up. His best friend Ian, who lived up the street, was similarly obsessed. Ian would come over to our house and the two of them would perch up at the table like a pair of dueling dandies.
"My name is Quentin Crisp." "No, my name is Quentin Crisp."
There was a period when everything they said to each other was in Quentinese.
"Ian, darling, would you like to join me on a bicycle ride?" "If it would bring a trace of pleasure to your afternoon, I'd be happy to."
As they walked out of the house, they glanced at my father, invariably passed out drunk on the couch, wearing just his underwear, and pronounce,
"It's a cry for help."
And giggling, the two of them would get on their bikes and pedal off into town. I fled to America in 1979. Quentin must have moved to New York a few years later. After living at the YMCA and a stint in Times Square, I found a tiny studio apartment on the Upper East Side. Occasionally, in the middle of the night, I would see Quentin on gay cable TV shows, dispensing wisdom, giving out his opinions to a fawning cable TV host. Simon was still living with my father in Luton. My father had been released from prison after serving a 3-year sentence, reduced to 18 months for good behavior, for the murder of our mother. Manslaughter, they called it, diminished responsibility. After coming out of prison, he'd been dropped back in our laps. Unsupervised by any probation officer or psychiatrist, he'd gone back to the booze and was coming up with insane theories about our mother, justifying why he did what he did. I'd walked away from it all early on, hoping to start a new life. My brother was still in Luton, living with a man who was more than likely certifiable, still in the house where our mother was killed. It was an insane situation, and Simon was deeply depressed. I kept badgering him to just get on a plane, and we'd figure it out when he got here. One day in 1984, the phone rang. It was Simon.
I'm on 49th Street.
He never went back. By the early 90s, Simon and I were both living in the same building in the East Village, in New York City. Living only 2 blocks away was Quentin Crisp. Seeing an 80-year-old Quentin on the streets of New York was how I imagined it must be for bird watchers spotting the rarest of warblers. On every sighting, my brother and I would call each other giddy with excitement. Spotting Quentin in a strange way was reassuring. Oh, the past did happen. We didn't make it up. It was our connection to England. We were all three, the men that got away. I saw Quentin on a bus one time. Although he must have been 80 years old, he stood up to offer a teenage girl a seat. The girl looked up at him in disbelief. Even though it was sweltering hot, Quentin was dressed in a black velvet suit and hat, with his purple-tinted silver hair billowing out of the sides, face lightly powdered. I was on a bill with him once, though I was too shy to say anything to him. I wrote this piece as a little homage. I thought, what about writing about a fictional encounter with Quentin Crisp on Rodeo Beach in San Francisco? I could just imagine Quentin perched on a rock, holding court, with sandpipers scuttling across the wet sand, a thin cloud floating in the clear sky, and the waves gently lapping the shore.
You know me through John Hurt's performance in The Naked Civil Servant, but that isn't me. John Hurt plays Quentin Crisp better than Quentin Crisp plays Quentin Crisp. You see, he's a better actor. I shall endeavour to give you my interpretation of the so-called Mr. Crisp, which may lack a little of Mr. Hurt's inherent charisma, or for that matter his sympathy for the subject. I came to America because of the movies, and have always lived my life as though there were a camera on me at all times. Even sitting on this beach, I automatically half-assumed the role of the film noir figure who's got away with the crime and escaped to a remote island, or the lonely widow looking out to sea for a ship that will never return. Once the movies get in your blood, there's no getting them out. Of course, the snobs will tell you that the theatre is superior to the movies, but it isn't. The theatre will always take second place because the theatre can't haunt you and the movies can. No amount of words can speak as loudly as a close-up on a human face, magnified 200 times and shot through with light. When I come to San Francisco, I feel I've stepped into Alfred Hitchcock country. In San Francisco, I'm Quentin Crisp, but in this location, I'm also Tippi Hedren in The Birds, or the two Kim Novaks in Vertigo. Seagulls aren't the same in San Francisco. Such is the power of the movies. When I climb a steep stairway, I can't forget Joan Crawford being chased around in sudden fear. When I look at Alcatraz, I expect Burt Lancaster to be inside with a canary perched on his finger. Mr. Hitchcock was right when he said, "The movies are like life, with all the dull parts cut out." We never had a San Francisco kind of town in England. We had areas of London that were homosexual. Of course, there are areas in every town. Some of them may be as small as a bathroom in a railway station, but they are everywhere. But we never had a homosexual town. There are now overt homosexuals everywhere, but back then they were rare creatures, at least in public view. And while you were afraid to walk on the street at times, you also felt special. A young friend took me to see a play last night. This young man who took me to the theatre last night asked me what advice I could give him. I told him, choose your role in life carefully, because sooner or later you will be stuck with it. Life is like Hollywood, I told him, it's quick to typecast. And never be a supporting player in your own life. Always cast yourself in the starring role. Your life is your vehicle, my dear. I wonder sometimes why more has not been written of the kindness of Americans. How many people in this country have taken me out to dinner, brought me to their homes? Strangers have come by my house and taken me to the movies. A lilac-haired, effeminate English homosexual in a strange land where I fit right in. Or you, my young friend, who have driven me to this beach to take in the great Pacific, because I represent something to you that you don't fully understand. But you see, I don't have the answer to anything. If we were in a movie right now, I think I might look toward the sea with a far-off look in my eyes and smile slightly as two white words come up over my face. The end.
The three works in Imagining Them were Wendy Spiro's Gary, Meg Wolitzer's Dead Men Tell No Tales, and David Cale's Hello, Who Wants Me? The music was by Stuart Rosenberg, and the director was Judith Kampfner. Imagining Them was a Corporation for Independent Media production for BBC Radio 4. Now, what have you got plugged in at the moment? If the answer is dozens of chargers, then Costing the Earth is the programme for you. Join Tom Heap after the news.
BBC News at 3 o'clock. A coroner has called for the RAF's entire fleet of Nimrod surveillance planes to be grounded, saying they have never been airworthy. The Assistant Deputy Coroner for Oxfordshire, Andrew Walker, was speaking at the end of an inquest into the deaths of 14 servicemen in a crash over Afghanistan. The relatives of those who died have welcomed his remarks. But the government insists the Nimrod is safe to fly, as does the RAF's most senior engineer, Air Marshal Sir Barry Thornton.
We have comprehensively reviewed every aspect of the safety of the and airworthiness of the Nimrod aircraft, not just internally within the Ministry of Defence, but using external experts. And everybody believes the aircraft is safe to fly with the measures that we have now put in place.
Labour MPs have been calling for new policies and a new cabinet after the party's heavy defeat in the Crewe and Nantwich by-election. Gordon Brown said he would address voters' concerns about the rising cost of fuel, food and utility bills. However, one Labour backbencher, Graham Stringer, said he'd like to see senior cabinet members challenging Mr Brown for the party leadership. The Conservative leader, David Cameron, said the by-election result spelled the end of New Labour, and he promised to build a coalition for change. The UN Secretary-General Ban Ki-moon says Burma's military leadership has agreed to let in all foreign aid workers to help the cyclone victims. Aid agencies have cautiously welcomed the breakthrough, but observers say Burma has reneged on